Chief Prosecutor of UFOs, Dr. Donald H. Menzel. Now, if I presented Dr. Menzel as he really should be presented, we would be here for the rest of the morning and you would never hear it. Let me skip briefly through a career that includes a Ph.D. from Princeton University, teaching tours at the University of Iowa and Ohio State University. In 1926, he went to Lick Observatory as assistant astronomer. In the fall of 1932, Dr. Menzel became associated with Harvard University, where he has been ever since, except for 3 years of service as a commander in the U.S. Navy during World War II. His studies have covered a large number of fields, from pure physics to pure astronomy. In 1936, he was the head director of the Harvard MIT Eclipse expedition to the USSR. In 1954, he became the director of the Harvard College Observatory and only resigned that position in 1966. In Harvard, he is Payne Professor of Practical Astronomy and Professor of Astrophysics. He has been president of the American Astronomical Society. Dr. Menzel has been a prolific writer. His books, articles, and scientific papers cover a broad field and have been translated into many languages. He has even ventured briefly into the realm of science fiction. There is no end to this man's accomplishment. I am highly honored to present Dr. Donald H. Menzel of Harvard University.
Well, I too have examined the evidence, and I have drawn slightly different conclusions from those presented by the previous speaker. Similar sightings of flying saucers go far back in history, where they have assumed different forms for different people. Old records refer to them as fiery dragons, fiery chariots, will-o'-the-wisp jack-o'-lanterns, fire drakes, foxfire, and even the devil himself. And now we are having urged on us a new legend to explain a rash of mysterious sightings. Certain UFO buffs argue that the peculiar properties and maneuvers of these apparitions, as reported by reliable people of all different kinds, are so remarkable that only one explanation for them is possible. They must be vehicles from outer space, manned by beings far more intelligent than we, because the operators have clearly built vehicles capable of something far beyond anything we can conceive of. This is the argument that we are asked to accept. On the face of it, it sounds much like the reasoning of Sherlock Holmes, who said on several occasions, "It is an old maxim of mine that when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." I'm willing to go along with this formula, but only after we have followed Holmes and excluded every possibility but that of manned UFOs. And we must also show that no further possibilities exist. The believers, I feel, are much too eager to reach a decision, and their method is quite simple. They try to find someone whom they can establish as an authority, someone who will support their views. Then they quote and often misquote various authorities, or they misquote one another until they believe what they are saying. Having no real logic on their side, they resort to innuendo and ridicule and try to discredit those who fail to support their view. The UFO magazines all refer to me as the archdemon of saucerdom. To the buffs, all sightings are true UFOs unless proved otherwise. I concede that the concept of man's spaceships is not an absolute impossibility. Neither are the concepts of ghosts, spirits, witches, fairies, elves, hobgoblins, or the devil. The only trouble with this last list is the fact that they are somewhat out of date. We live in the age of space. Isn't it natural that the beings from outer space should exhibit a similar interest in us? But when we consider that these beings, if indeed they are beings, have been bugging us for centuries, why should not one have landed on the White House lawn and shown himself to the President of the United States, to a member of the National Academy of Sciences, or at least to some one of you editors? Now, please don't misunderstand me. I think it's very possible that intelligent life, hopefully more intelligent than we, may exist somewhere in the vast reaches of outer space. But it's the very vastness of this space that complicates the problem. The distances are almost inconceivable. The time required to reach the Earth, even at speeds comparable with that of light, range in hundreds, if not thousands of years, for some of our near neighbors. And it takes light some billions of years to reach us from the most distant galaxies, times comparable with that for the entire life history of our solar system. The number of habitable planets in the universe is anybody's guess. Any figures you've heard, including mine, are just guesses. I have guessed that our own Milky Way may contain as many as a million such planets. That sounds like a lot, but the chances are that if this figure is right, the nearest inhabited planet would be so far away that if we sent out a message to it today, we should have to wait about 2,000 years to get a reply. Alas, the evidence is poor for intelligent life in our solar system, although I would rather expect to find some low forms of life on the planet Mars. With respect to UFOs, my position is simply this, that other natural explanations exist. Dr. McDonald, to the contrary, for the unexplained sightings. The Air Force has given me full access to their files. I concur with Dr. McDonald that there is no vast conspiracy either at the Air Force or CIA to conceal the facts from the public, as many groups have charged. The Air Force has made its mistakes. They never have had enough scientists in the project. They have failed to follow up certain sightings of special importance. And to me, their questionnaire is amateurish, almost cleverly designed in certain cases to get the wrong answer and lose track of the facts. The Air Force is aware of my criticism, and at Major Quintanilla's invitation, I have been making constructive criticisms and trying to help them in a revision of the questionnaire. And it is not an easy job. From 1947 until 1954, a bewildered group of Air Force personnel tried honestly and sincerely to resolve the UFO problem. Many highly reliable persons had reported seeing objects moving at fantastic speeds and apparently taking evasive action in a manner impossible for known terrestrial craft. By 1952, a sizable number of those in the Air Force group had concluded that extraterrestrial vehicles were the only explanation. Some of this unrest leaked out. Popular writers exploited these ideas, and soon various UFO clubs came into existence. In 1953, as you've heard, a committee of scientists, headed by H.P. Robertson of Caltech, met at CIA to consider a number of Air Force's most convincing cases. These cases were the supposedly the ones that had convinced the Air Force personnel who had worked on them, just the 20 or 30 most outstanding cases, the ones that looked as if there was absolutely no other explanation except UFOs from outer space to account for the sightings. The Robertson Committee immediately solved a number of them, and the rest they could not solve because of poor or insufficient data. The questionnaire again. They concluded that all cases had a natural solution, and the report states that there is no evidence to support the idea that UFOs are vehicles from another world. Nevertheless, the UFO buffs believe, almost as an article of faith, that special observers such as military or airline pilots, couldn't possibly mistake a meteor or a planet or a star, a sundog or a mirage for a UFO. This viewpoint is absolute nonsense, and the Air Force files bear witness to its falsity. They contain thousands of solved cases, sightings by the same kind of reliable individuals like the pilots. But such persons have often made huge errors in the identification. A huge meteor flashes by in the sky. The co-pilot thinks it is going to strike the plane and takes evasive action. He may even imagine that the plane is hit by the backwash from this UFO. The pilot disagrees, and the pilot is right. The UFO proves to be a bright fireball or meteor 100 miles away. Such occurrences are frequent, not rare. Distances, especially in space, are hard to estimate. If you're up in the air, things that you see may be... you may think that they're 100 feet away from you, and they actually may be a star that is clear back in the firmament. A bird's feather shining in the sun to someone on the ground, floating a mere 20 feet overhead, may seem to be a distant object moving at a very high speed. Conversely, a pilot may think that the bright object on the horizon and just beyond his wingtip is a UFO. And a layer of warm air, sandwiched between two layers of cold air, can sometimes act as a lens, projecting a pulsing, spinning, vividly colored saucer-like image of a planet. I have seen this phenomenon myself, despite the fact that the previous speaker in his lengthy manuscript tries to discredit my sighting. Pilots thinking they were dealing with a nearby flying object have often tried to intercept such images, which evade, of course, all attempts to cut it off. The distance may seem to change rapidly as the star fades or increases in intensity, because as the pilot flies along, the star may even be completely cut off at times by a mountain or by a forest, and will seem to buzz in and out from the plane, attacking the plane. It's realistic and very frightening. The observations of this type fortified the UFO legend that these objects maneuver as if under intelligent control. But the pilots failed to realize that the intelligent control came from within themselves. And I think that the Air Force personnel of Project Blue Book still do not appreciate this important UFO phenomenon. Mirages aren't the only apparitions that appear to maneuver. I think I was the first person to point out that a special kind of reflection of the sun or moon from ice crystals, sometimes called a sun dog or moon dog, can also perform evasive action. Layers of ice crystals are necessary, like those found in cirrus clouds. An aviator flying through cirrus sometimes sees a peculiar metallic-appearing reflection. A reflection often has a reddish tinge on one side, a reflection of the sun or moon. He may elect to chase it. The apparition will recede. If approached, the pilot reverses course, and the object seems to execute evasive action. As the pilot runs out of ice crystals, the UFO will seem to put on a burst of speed and disappear into the distance. It's the ice crystal analog of a rainbow. But such behavior does not imply, as the UFO addicts try to imply, the presence of an intelligent pilot to guide it. As we look over the Air Force files, we find that some 90% of the solved cases result from the presence of material objects in the atmosphere, reflections from planes banking in the sun. Then balloons, child balloons, weather balloons, lighted or unlighted, especially those enormous plastic balloons as large as a 10-story building which carry scientific instruments, sometimes to 100,000 feet. Reflecting full sunlight while the earth below lies in dim twilight. Such balloons shine more brilliantly than Venus. Advertising flames or illuminated blips. Birds, by day or night, often reflect light from their shiny backs. Wind-blown kites, hats, paper, plastic sacks, feathers, spider webs, seed pods, dust devils, have all contributed their share of UFO sightings. Insects, single insects or insects in swarms, saucer-shaped clouds, reflection of searchlight on clouds. A special space experiment such as rocket-launched sodium vapor releases or balloon launched from rockets from Wallops Island have also produced spectacular apparitions visible all up and down the East Coast. Ball lightning and the aurora borealis occasionally contribute. Reflections from power lines, insulators, television antennas, radar, radio telescopes, even apartment windows. These two have, on their turn, produced realistic UFOs, and I could go on adding almost indefinitely to this list. But the chief point that I want to make is that a simple phenomenon, like any of the above, tricked intelligent people into reporting a UFO. But there are still a few other phenomena that can produce UFOs of a type that, as far as I know, the Air Force still does not recognize, and I think I'm bringing them to the public's attention for the first time today. You'll see occasional reference to some of these phenomena, but only indirectly. Let me quote from an article on Vision in McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. Any observant person can detect swirling clouds or spots of light in total darkness, or while looking at a homogeneous field such as a bright blue sky. So if you want to see flying saucers, just look up. And if you don't see them, you probably aren't observant. I see them, or I can see them, most clearly in a dark room or on a moonless night with the sky even darker with heavy clouds. I find the background of stars on a clear night somewhat distracting. But just lie down on your back, open your eyes, and see the saucer spin. You'll almost surely see bright, irregular patches of light form. Some of them seem gray-green, but I occasionally see silver or gold and occasionally red. I can even imagine windows in some of them. As you move your eyes, they will move across the sky. They'll cavort across the sky. To speed up the action, just rub your eyes like a person coming out of a sleep. And occasionally the whole field will become large and luminous. Now I ask you, how can you be sure that the UFO reported by an airline pilot is not just one of these spurious images? And even if an alerted co-pilot confirms it, he might also be responding to a similar effect in his own eyes, since you don't know that he is seeing exactly the same thing that the other man is reporting. The chemistry and physiology of the human eye are certainly responsible for many UFO sightings. The eye responds in a different way to different kinds of stimuli. A sudden burst of bright light, like that coming from a flashbulb. You newspaper editors, especially the photographers down here in the first row, should know that when you look at a sudden flash, you will have an enduring effect on the eye. The light produces an immediate change in the so-called visual purple of the retina, in a sense. The retinal spot where the light fell on the eye becomes fatigued, and for some minutes after the flash, you'll be able to see a bright, usually greenish floating spot, which could be mistaken for a UFO by someone unfamiliar with the problem. But let me take an actual case, which is typical of a large number in the files of Project Blue Book. A child going to the bathroom turns on a bright light and accidentally awakens one of his parents, who is blinded by the sudden illumination. The child turns off the light, and the parent, for some reason, also gets up and just happens to glance out of the window. He is startled to see a peculiar spot of light floating over the trees and making irregular, jerky motions. He watches the UFO for a minute or two until it finally disappears. He can't be blamed for failing to realize that the erratic and often rapid movements of the UFO are due to the similar movements of his own eye. The UFO simply appears in the direction in which he happens to be looking, and that's all. And yet he may describe it graphically as a luminous object cavorting across the sky. Many such stimuli are possible by day and night. A few weeks ago, I was driving toward the setting sun. I came to a stoplight and looked out the side window of the car. I was startled to see a large black object shaped something like a dirigible, surrounded by dozens of small black balloons. I suddenly realized that these were after images of the sun. The big one was where I'd been looking most fixedly. The spots were images where my eye had wandered. A UFO buff could have sworn that he was seeing a mothership and a swarm of UFOs in rapid flight. I once had another similar experience. I suddenly glanced up and was surprised to see a whole flotilla of UFOs in formation across the sky. They looked like after images, but I hadn't been conscious of the visual stimulus responsible. I quickly retraced my steps and found it. Sunlight reflected from the shiny surface of the fender of a parked car. I am sure that many UFOs, still unknowns, belong in this class. Sometimes look fixedly at the moon for at least 30 seconds, and then turn away. A greenish balloon will swim over your head and perform maneuvers startling or impossible for any real object. I have been able to attain the same effect with the planet Venus when near maximum brilliance. Yet most observers will swear that such UFOs are true objects. And the Air Force questionnaire, failing to recognize even the existence of this kind of UFO, contains not a single question that would help them identify it. In fact, the words signifying UFO, unidentified flying object, show the state of mind of the Air Force personnel who invented this abbreviation. What I am saying is that the UFOs are not unidentifiable. They are often not flying, and many are not even objects. It is this point of view, to regard the apparitions as actual solid objects, that has retarded the solution so long. After images possess still another complicated characteristic. A colored light tends to produce an after image of complementary color. A green flash will cause a red after image, and vice versa. Colorblind persons and persons with defective vision will often experience effects different from those of people with normal eyesight. Another phenomenon can produce an illusion. You may forget that the eyeball jumps a little every time that you blink. Walking transmits vibrations to the eye at every step. Many individuals think they see stars, planets, or satellites oscillating when the movement is actually that of the eye itself. Let me give you this quotation from a book. On our return across Minnesota, we had an experience of which I have always remembered as illustrative of the fallacy of all human testimony about ghosts, rappings, and other phenomena of that character. We spent two nights and a day at Fort Snelling. Some of the officers were greatly surprised by a celestial phenomenon of a very extraordinary character, which had been observed for several nights past. A star had been seen, night after night, rising in the east as usual and starting on its course toward the south. But instead of continuing that course across the meridian, as stars invariably had done from the remotest antiquity, it took a turn toward the north, sunk toward the horizon, and finally set near the north point of the horizon. Of course, an explanation was wanted. My assurance there must be some mistake in this observation could not be accepted, because this erratic course of the heavenly body had been seen by all of them so plainly that no doubt could exist on the subject. The men who saw it were not of the ordinary, untrained kind, but graduates of West Point, who, if anyone, ought to be free from optical deceptions. I was myself confidently invited to look out that night at sea. We all watched with the greatest of interest. In due time, the planet Mars was seen in the east, making its way toward the south. "There it is," was the exclamation. Yes, there it is, said I. Now that planet is going to keep right on its course toward the south. No, it is not, said they. You will see it turn around and go down towards the north. Hour after hour passed, and as the planet began, continued on its regular course, the other watchers began to get a little nervous. It showed no signs of deviating from its course. We went out from time to time to look at the sky. There it is, said one of the observers at length, pointing to Capella, which was now just rising a little to the east of north. There is the star setting. No, it isn't, said I. There is the star we've been looking at, now quite inconspicuous near the meridian. And that star that you think is setting is really rising and will soon be higher up. A very little additional watching showed that no deviation of the general laws of nature had occurred, but that the observers of previous nights had jumped at the conclusion that two objects, widely apart in the heavens, were the same. Those words came from a book called Reminiscences of an Astronomer, published in 1903 by Simon Newcomb, who was in charge of the American Nautical Almanac Office from 1877 until 1897. This event actually occurred in 1860. The similarity to modern UFOs is overpowering. A star cavorting across the sky. Military officers as reliable and responsible witnesses. For you who wear eyeglasses, there's still another way of seeing a UFO. Look directly at some bright light. There's a lot of them around the room here. Keep your head turned slightly to the left or right, and you'll undoubtedly see a faint roundish out-of-focus spot. This is light reflected from the front surface of your eyeball back to the lens, and then back into the pupil of your eye. A bright source to one side and slightly behind you could also reach your eye through reflections from the internal surface of the spectacle lens. To this moment, I haven't mentioned that still another method of detecting saucers. One not subject to the vagaries of the human eye. I mean radar. Radar is a machine. It can't make mistakes. Or at least that is the common argument advanced by the UFO buffs. The previous speaker in the document referred to violently discredits my work and reveals his ignorance of the phenomenon of radio propagation of these radar waves. So happens that during my 3-year service in the Navy, which has already been referred to, and 22 years since then as consultant to the Central Radio Propagation Laboratory of the National Bureau of Standards, I have had a little experience with this particular phenomenon, and the conditions, although radar is cursed with all the potential afflictions that any complicated electrical gadget can suffer, there's one specific thing that can affect this greatly, mirage. Let me explain briefly what a radar does. It sends out a pulse of radio waves. We know the direction, northeast. We know the elevation above the horizon. An echo returns. From the interval between the transmission and the return of the signal, we know how far away the object is that reflects the pulse. We think, therefore, we detect a plane or a UFO in flight because the radar directs its pulse upward. But we haven't any way of following the pulse in its path toward the target. A layer of warm, dry air, or even a layer containing a few bubbles of warm air, will bend the radar beam back to Earth. This is what we call partial trapping, and this was, for example, what happened in Washington at the famous sighting in 1952. The reflection of the beam, after it has been directed backward, comes back from a distant building, a train, or a ship. No wonder that planes that were sent out to intercept the radar UFO found in nothing. In one such case, a well-known writer on flying saucers said the discovery of visible saucers had been serious enough. The discovery of invisible flying saucers would be enough to frighten anyone. I know of no reliable cases of simultaneous visual and radar sightings. In view of the physical properties of the eye, the surprising fact is that so few cases have been reported. Time won't permit me to elaborate on still another relevant phenomenon. the Air Force appears to have neglected completely the psychological angle of mass illumination, of mass hallucination. Back in 1919 in Spain, a not unrelated phenomenon occurred. Thousands of people, reliable people, swore that they had seen the images of saints rolling their eyes, moving their hands, dripping drops of blood, even stepping out of their panels. A person would call out, "Look, there it goes," and everyone else would look at it and they would see this phenomenon. There are many similar events recorded through history. Then there are hundreds and thousands, perhaps, of hoaxes, like that at the University of Colorado when some enterprising pranksters made hot air balloons from candles and plastic bags. And it gave the university officials who were investigating the UFO phenomenon the opportunity to see how poor the evidence can be, a fact well known to the legal profession. This is another point that the Air Force has sometimes failed to realize. Moreover, their poor questionnaire has only further confused an already confused picture. Several times during this talk, I have used the phrase UFOs cavorting across the sky. I did so deliberately because it seems to be a favorite phrase of my good friend, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, of Northwestern University and consultant to the Air Force, Project Blue Book. He has sometimes expressed doubts about the UFO because stars don't cavort across the sky. What I have tried to show today is that many kinds of optical stimuli can produce weird effects. With all these kinds of phenomena masquerading as UFOs, many of them, like those related to the physiology of the human eye, still practically not investigated, I think I can reasonably claim, applying the criterion of Sherlock Holmes, that we have not excluded all of the impossible. I have shown that the arguments advanced in favor of the interplanetary nature of UFOs are fallacious. Their alleged high speeds and ability to maneuver, their alleged short distances are completely underestimated, and they have natural explanations. I think it is time for the Air Force to wrap up Project Blue Book. It has produced little scientific value. Keeping it going only fosters the belief of persons that the Air Force must have found something to substantiate belief in the UFO. In making this recommendation, I'm not criticizing the present or recent administration of the project. But it's time that we put an end to chasing ghosts, hobgoblins, visions, and hallucinations. And as for the true believers, bless their little hearts, let them go on believing in UFOs, fairies, or Santa Claus if they want to. Nothing will change their mind. They'll go on forever demanding more dollars for investigation and more congressional investigation of the UFOs and the Air Force. Incidentally, we did get, I'd like to mention that a complete discussion of many of these phenomena will appears in my book, The World of Flying Saucers, by Mrs. Boyd and myself.